reading about typology. But typology is looking for the recurring patterns, the themes, based on the historical context of what's going on at the times. Focusing on God's work at the times. So when we look at the book of Job, we're trying to look at these patterns. We're looking at God's plan in those historical times. God's work in those times. Now I'm going to read for a second here a little bit of chapter 1. And as we read it, Chris, you remember the number of sheep. And Dinah, you got the camels. How many camels there is going to be. And Nancy, how many yoke of oxen? And what the heck, Sue? You got the female donkeys. All right? So you have to remember that until the end. If you remember nothing else, you'll remember those numbers. All right. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke and oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. So we'll read a little bit more at the end. But let's talk a little bit about the typology here. Most of what I'm going to be talking about is based on 2 different theologians. One, that's where a lot of the stuff comes from in addition to this book. But one is C.J. Williams, who just recently wrote a book on the book of Job. And he is with the Reformed Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And so I picked that up at the last Presbytery meeting and started thumbing through it. And it's a pretty darn good book. I've read chapters of it. The other part that we're going to focus on here is based on the Hebrew tradition. And it's from a guy named Rabbi Berkowitz. And I think he's out of New York City, but I'm not 100% sure. So those two are the people that said a lot of these things, and I kind of smushed the thought process together here. So the big paradox of the book of Job is based on the fact that we live in this world. We live in this world. We want everything to be great, but it's not. And the paradox is, basically, why do bad things happen to good people? Now, we could think in terms of worst-case scenarios, but let's not. Let's think about that flower, Nancy. All right? You were worried about those flowers dying. You were worried about Bill taking in a flower, what you were going to put it in. And then you were worried about what you were going to do with it. A paradox. How many of you have a constant nagging in the pit of your stomach? I do. For a number of reasons. Well, I have numbers of little knots in my stomach at all time. It's just the nature of the beast. So from the minuscule things to the large, grandiose things, we suffer with these paradoxes. And really what we're dealing with is a series of perplexing issues. We're here in this world, and we're suffering. All at a different level, we're suffering. This isn't just a modern-day world problem. This is a problem that has gone on since the beginning of humans, beginning of man, after Adam and Eve left the garden. Moses struggled with it. Moses said to God, "Show me your ways. Explain this to me. What's going on here? Why isn't it all just easy? We're trying to be righteous. Why isn't it working out?" And God says, "I'll be gracious to those I want to be gracious to. And I'll be merciful to those I want to be merciful to." I'm paraphrasing a bit, but that's essentially what he says. So the theme of Job is the theme of the suffering of the righteousness, or the righteous, the suffering of the righteous people. Now, we read in here about Job, and I guess the first thing that pops into my head is Job, and I hate to say this on tape, is Job Jewish? Is he Hebrew? I don't know. I don't know if he is. It's a long, long time ago. He certainly was a righteous man. What was his connection to religion at that time? It's really hard to say. I think he believed in God. But how formed was the religious institution at that time? He certainly had burnt offerings that he celebrated and he worshipped with. But at the time, the thought process was, for Hebrews, for other people of other religious groups, basically, if you lived a good life, you would be rewarded. That was a common thought process. And if you tried to live righteously, these rewards would be in people admiring you, strong families, lots of children, lots of animals. You'd acquire wealth. So all those things come together. And on that, the stage is set. Okay? And that's the section of the introduction of chapter 1 of the book of Job. Job is righteous. He loves God. He prays for the sins of his children. And he wants God to take care of them. From there we move into the second chapter and the third chapter. And we have a change in scenes. It's no longer about Job. It's about God. And it's about what Rabbi Berkowitz calls this El Satan. Now, Christian theology, we talk about Satan. In the Hebrew tradition, we talk about, or they talk about, El Satan. El Satan is like, we can't think of it as Christians. We have to think about it as Hebrews of 3,000, 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. El Satan is somebody on the council with God, an angel perhaps, and he could be thought of as the prosecutor, somebody that plays the devil's advocate, somebody that might be serving as the district attorney looking at filing charges. But in the Christian tradition, we read this and we think of Satan. That's how that comes together there. And what does El Satan or Satan say from what you remember last time you read the book of Job? Job ain't so good. He's not that great of a guy. Yeah, everybody thinks he's righteous, but he's not that righteous. How does God respond? God says, yeah, of course he is. He's the best there is out there. He's the best there is out there. And there's three things that come into play at this point. Satan says, of course he serves you. He's got everything he wants. He's rich. He's got kids. He's got animals. He's got plenty of time because he's got all these servants. Why wouldn't he be righteous? It's good to be king. It's good to be in charge. So that's the first thing. The second thing is Satan says, well, what happens if we start removing some of these comforts? Do you think he's really going to worship you, God? Is he really going to do that? And then basically, if we're looking this in the context as Satan being the devil's advocate, for whatever reason, God says, sure, Satan, I'll take your bet. I'll go along with what you're saying. And let's do a test. Let's figure this out. Let's bet on it. Now, why would God ever bet? I mean, I'm presumptuous to even give you an answer to that because it's way above and beyond me. But God puts a couple of conditions on the bet. The first thing is, don't kill Job. If you kill Job, we'll never know how the bet turns out. So that's off limits. And his wife has to be spared, and his friends have to be spared. That's all the conditions that we're putting on here. So it's kind of like, you can't kill Job, you can't kill the wife, you can't kill the friends. That would be like doing an operation on somebody and the operation being successful, but the patient dies. So, then things start happening as Job, and he's clueless. He's clueless. First thing that happens, early chapters of Job, bunch of marauders come in, and they wipe him clean. They take his animals, they kill his animals, they take his wealth away from him. And Job's like, what's going on here? I thought I was righteous. Second thing that happens, house collapses. Everybody dies inside the house. Not his wife, not his friends, his kids. They all die, and a whole bunch of servants die too. And what's the third thing that happens to Job? You all know this. A couple chapters later. I'll give you a hint. He's getting sick. He's ill. He's cantankerous. He's got boils all over his body. He can't even wear clothes anymore because his body hurts so bad. Just in pain. And his wife says to him, why don't you just curse God? Just curse God. Get it over. Get it done with. Let him strike you down. Let him kill you. It'll be better. And Job's response is, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. I don't want to do that. I can't do that. God gave me the wealth he gave me. He gave me my children. He gave me my prosperity. And for whatever reason, God gave to me and God took away. You've heard the expression, God gives, God takes away. You've heard that. That's in chapter 1, early part of chapter 2. It's a lot deeper than that. I think that was quoted by Shakespeare. And it's actually a lot more complicated of a book than God takes. Actually, it's a lot simpler. It's more Christ-like than God gives, God takes away. There's a whole typology going on here. So, to counsel Job, his friends come along. And he's got these friends. Now, there's no telephones, there's no mail, there's no messengers sent to the friends. They just know they got to go visit Job. Why are they going to visit Job? They got a hunch something is wrong. Now, do you ever get a hunch that something's wrong with your spouse, your kid, your dog? You ever have those hunches? Well, Job's friends had those hunches too. And they knew enough to get on their donkeys and horses and travel a couple days to go see Job. And Job accepts his friends. His friends come in, and they do something in the Hebrew tradition called sitting Shiva. Anybody ever hear of that before? Sit Shiva? It's where you come in and you counsel or console somebody in mourning, but you don't say anything. And sitting Shiva usually takes about 7 days. So if a spouse to somebody dies, you would go and sit Shiva, where you stay in their tent or their house, and you would just sit there and be with them. One of the awkward things that we do in our culture is we go to a funeral and we feel compelled to have to say something to the person closest to the person that died. And when we do that, sometimes we don't really say the right thing. Sometimes we just blurt out things and say, oh, why did I say that? Why should I have said that? When the important thing is not what comes out of your mouth, the important thing is that you're there with that person, praying with that person. Because many of the words that we say are meaningless at that time. So, sitting Shiva involves sitting there quietly and waiting for the mourner to ask questions and start the conversation. Moving from there in Job, we see that there's a series of conversations that take place. And it's a philosophical debate. That's the literary structure of it. It's a series of philosophical debates. There are three friends that visit Job. And the first time through, friend one says something. You must have done something bad. What did you do that was bad? That's why you're in this situation. And Job responds. And then friend two says something. Then friend three says something. This happens twice over however many days. And that's after the 7 days of sitting Shiva. So there's one period of time where there's questions and responses by Job. And Job, in each of these responses, puts his friend in place. Now, did you ever... I do this to Patrice all the time, or she does it to me. If I'm sick, and she wants me to do something, and I don't do it, she gets angry. And she has a right to, because she's trying to take care of me. She's trying to make sure that I get well as soon as possible. And then she gets angry. And sometimes she's gotten really angry and she walks out of the room, rightly so, and this shouldn't be on tape, but it is. And she is in the right and I am in the wrong, but she leaves the room or something. Well, the third time through this process, friend one has the conversation with Job. Job sanctions and questions the friend. The second friend comes through, the same exact thing. Job retorts the person. And the friend number three is gone. Friend number three is not mentioned. And the reason for that is thought to be that he got ticked off and he left the tent and he went back to his home. So With friend three leaving, somehow another friend comes and has the dialogue that friend three should have had. This is friend four, we'll call him that. So each time one of the friends tells Job he has sinned and he's not righteous, and find out why he's not righteous, find out why you're not righteous, reflect on it, figure it out, what are you doing wrong, Job? And Job is, I'm simplifying it quite a bit, and Job says, it's not about me. It's not about me at all. So the conventional view of the culture is, if you obey God, you will be rewarded. That's what the friends are saying. And this view is of conventional morality of the time. And we still kind of have that conventional morality in our society. The friends are saying, Job, you must have done stuff. You ain't as righteous as you think you are. You're just not. You can't be. Look what's happening to you. Nobody even wants to sit with you. Your body is sore. You stink. Nobody wants to be by you. And Job's response is continuously, I did nothing wrong. Anger with Job's friends, and they're disgusted, and they leave on him. So there's some psychological issues that are at play here too. And these psychological issues are kind of separate, but they're part of the topology. One, the friends are starting to get angry. One of them has walked off. The other two are getting ticked off. Suffer if you think that's what you want to do. If you don't want to listen to me, we're leaving. I'm leaving. And that's essentially what's going on with the friends. And those that are still sticking around are saying, if God wants you to suffer, you're going to suffer, and it's because you sinned. All right. So then a little bit further on, after the chapters about the conversation with the friends goes on, God enters again. Another scene is played out here. God says, I'm here. I'm here. What kind of questions do you have, Job? Let's talk about it. And Job says nothing. He doesn't say anything to God. God knows the question. God responds to the question. And he does that by saying initially, your friends are wrong. You are right, Job. You are righteous. Your friends are wrong. And God also says the question that you never asked me but is in your heart is the right question. And let me explain this all to you. And then there's a litany that goes on here in the book of Job about creation and the animals and clean water and all the beautiful majesty of everything that God has given us. God says, I don't think you could do any better, Job. This is it. This is everything. This is the beauty that God has given us. And Job responds, and the response to what God says by Job in Hebrew can be translated as, I have been comforted by what you've just told me, and I regret any thoughts, subliminal thoughts I may have had about you. Two things. And the Hebrew word in the original translation is nihumpi. Now, the response to this can be shown in the ending chapters of Job. And I'm not done talking yet, but we're going to read We are going to read Job 42 from 10 on. And the Lord restored... Oh, wait a second. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before and ate bread with him in his house. And they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the later days of Job more than his beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys. He had also 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the names of the first daughters Jemima, and the name of the second Kiza, and the name of the third Karin Hapuch. And in all the land there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters. And their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons 4 generations. And Job died an old man and full of days. So how many more sheep did he have, Chris? Twofold. Dinah? Camels? All right, from 3,000? Twofold. Jeremy? Who did I ask? Nancy? Doubled them. And Sue? Doubled the donkeys. Everything doubled. And he also lived longer and saw several generations of children. Now, yeah, we can get this done. Let's think a little bit about Job throughout what's going on here. There are 3 philosophical things that can happen in this story. If we could read this one way, and we could say, God plays a bully. He's picking on Job. But that's not in Christian thought, and that's not in Hebrew thought. That would be what somebody that has no concept of Christianity or Judaism would read, or even Muslim for that effect. All right? It could be worse. I can make it worse. Sinners in the hand of an angry God. So we're just here to be played by the bully. And that is not a Christian attitude. The second thought, which makes a little bit more sense and is a little bit more reasonable, is God communicates to Job about the complexity of the plan. The plan here is thought of as a, let's say, a 4,000, 5,000 year play. And this play that takes place, Job is just this much of it. And Bill is just this much of it. So you're in this play, Bill. I'm putting you on the spot here. And you have 1 second in the play. And in that play, you read the script and you have to go out and step on a banana peel and you slip and you fall. You would want to change that part. You think your part is more significant than falling on a banana peel. You would want to change that. But in this case, that's not God's plan. God's plan is for you to step on that banana peel. That's just part of something. You are one cog in a very big wheel called God's plan. We're all one part of that wheel, a very small cog. So looking at things individually, we want to think we're in control, but we're not. God's in control. It's not our plan. It's all together, though. We make up a small part, but bigger than it was if it's just us. So God's justice is really beyond our comprehension. God's justice is broader and on His time scale. As an analogy, let's think about it in terms of, I don't know, bread. Go out to a field. It looks beautiful this time of year. But the farmer has to turn it. He has to desiccate it. It has to be burned off or sprayed with chemicals. Everything's got to be killed. That's a bad thing. But then it's seeded. And the next year, you have this nice, lush field of grain. You could say, wow, that looks beautiful. But then, you got to cut it down. And it looks like havoc again. And you get all these little sheaves of grain. And you look at them and you say, wow, look at that, that's beautiful. But then you got to run them through a grinder. And you got to crush them and pulverize them. You got to turn them into flour. And then all you got is flour. But it looks kind of pretty because it's all consistent colors. It's easy to touch. It's fun to touch. And then you got to mix it up with other stuff and it gets hard and rough. And you got to heat it up. But you get the idea. Things look bad, they look good. They look bad, they look good. The change is constant. And that could be considered like God's justice for us. God has a plan. Okay? The third way. So we looked at two. God's the bully. God has a complex plan. And the third way we could look at this, if I am righteous, why is this happening? Does God ever answer that question? No. He never answers that question. Just the idea that we are asking that question of God should be good enough. We should be able to trust in God since we're asking Him that question. That should be enough. Getting the answer is irrelevant. Having the peace to know that there is a God that we could ask the question to should do it. We don't need an explanation. And God responds, just know I'm with you. It'll all work out. You're a cog. You're part of the wheel. So, if we know we're not alone, we should find strength in that. We should find hope in that. And we should find resilience in that. But the question's going to remain unanswered. So the book of Job is about trusting, coping, and the most important part of it is about spiritual growth. The contentment in being able to be angry at God and find in our heart to pray. To be trusting of God. And to know that God is there even if we don't hear the answers. So it's all about spiritual growth, and it's about valuing our little part in the cog of the big wheel. And as we grow and as we understand our place in the cog, it's about our righteousness and the grace that comes from God. Mick Jagger, Rolling Stones. You can't always get what you want, right? You're a music lover, right? You can't always get what you want, but you get what you need. Right. So, that is the context of the topology of the book of Job. And I hate to close it with a quote by Mick Jagger. But I'm doing that. But there's a trajectory here that we have to understand. Because as Christians, we have to tie this Old Testament book to the New Testament. And we could think of Job as going through a period of good things, then a period of really, really bad things. And then we saw in the last verses about the good things again. But the good things aren't always about cows and donkeys and kids and money. Those good things really are about our righteousness and our love for Jesus, our love for God. What are some other examples in the Old Testament that kind of focus us the same way? Were some examples in the Old Testament similar to Job's, where things were good, things went south, and then they were good again. Joseph. Awesome stories about Joseph. The exact same thing, only different. Well, I probably shouldn't say that. That's on tape. Very different thing. Another one. King David, exactly. Same thing, only different. Another one. Lot, yes. What about Abraham having to sacrifice his son? Same thing. So, all those examples are taking a look at what we could consider the messianic trajectory, the connection to Christ, the connection to the New Testament. And we could connect that to Jesus. Think about Jesus. And it's the Reader's Digest version, and a theologian will rip me apart, I'm sure. Everything's going along pretty good. Riding into town on a donkey. Then things get bad. They get worse. They get worse. They get worse. And what happens? He rises from the dead. He comes back. He lives with the people. Now, Job is not Christ. There's no way Job is Christ. It just Job points to Christ. The same way Joseph, Moses, David, Lot point to Christ. And we have to make sure that we always see that connection. Good, bad, things happen. Righteous people survive. Jesus rose again. Jesus rose again. But now here's the separation between Jesus and these heroes or saints of the Old Testament. Jesus had a certain authority that the other ones did not, that we do not. He is more exalted than everyone. He is more exalted. And he has a more exalted position than everyone. So, I think that as we read through the book of Job, we should read about the banter between the friends and Job. Because we go through that banter every day. When we turn on the television, we have that banter. It's not our friend. But sometimes we treat the television more like a friend than we do our friends. We spend more time with it. When we work with our colleagues, think about Job and the trajectory here. Think about the banter back and forth. We prayed with Jeremy about the transformation of his workplace. It's almost the same kind of thing, just without all the scabs on Jeremy's skin. And that's getting a little too personal. So we all have these kind of things we're dealing with. And they're all at different levels. And we all have something in the pit of our stomachs that's ailing us. We all do. That's part of sin in the world. But what we have to realize is that we don't have to ask God why. We just have to know that God's there for us. And just having that is comforting. And having the trajectory to Jesus, one who went through the exact same thing, only different, but is exalted and has a further connection and is God, seeing that he has gone through those same things, only different, is a blessing for all of us. And I think that's all I have. So, we'll close with prayer. Father God, thank you for the book of Job. Thank you for Job's friends. Thank you for Job standing firm in the presence of his friends, not faltering, remaining convicted to his relationship with you. Thank you for the book of Job sending us the trajectory to our relationship with Christ, the messianic future. Please help us realize that we are cogs in a wheel, and we don't know the part, and we don't know the reasons why. But we do thank you. We thank you for being there. We thank you for letting us ask you why things are the way they are. Please help us find comfort, even if we don't get the answer right away from you. Please help us find comfort knowing that asking those questions, demanding answers to those questions, while it is a sinful nature of ours, it is humbling to know that you are there for us. We ask you bless us in Jesus' name. Amen.